Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of the Brain Injury Radio Network.
I'm ready to blow it just one more sound.
Brain Injury Radio and Radio Ability are sponsored by the TBI Network.
Find them on facebook.com/TBI Network or at tbifn.org.
Brain Injury Radio is on 7 nights a week, and now, for tonight's episode of Brain Injury Radio.
Caring for Caregivers of Trauma. I'm Terry Smith, your host. Good evening, good morning, or good afternoon, wherever you are on our planet Earth. If you're listening to us live or to an archived show, we wish you love and harmony, especially on this planet right now. Tonight, we're talking about caring for caregivers of trauma. We're going to discuss the mind and body of our precious caregivers. Caregivers are people too. And we're going to discuss tonight the importance of maintaining your body and mind, because caregiving is tough business. We're going to discuss exercising the body, eating well, and brain fitness. And mind, depression, and anxiety, denial, and guilt, and anger. And we're going to discuss it all night. We may not take calls tonight because we have a lot of information to give you. Before we get started with that, I'd like to qualify the caregivers we're focusing on tonight primarily are older caregivers, and we're going to discuss caring for Alzheimer's, severe TBI, strokes, and other neurological disorders. So everything that you hear tonight is geared to that demographic. And before we get started, we'd like to say hello to Donna and wish her healing with her pain. And say hello to our co-host who is not with us tonight because, well, we have a lot of information and there's really not a lot of conversation. It's just giving you information. Michelle, we wish you well too. And here we go. Let's talk about it. We're talking that caregiving is a tough business because it requires tremendous reserves of physical strength and stamina. As caregivers, we need to keep up with our daily tasks and be physically able to help our loved ones as they lose the ability to help themselves. Because being able to stay active throughout the day and often through much of the night, they're constantly called upon. So over time, the physical demands of caregiving can put caregivers at a greater risk for the average person for illness. And chronic fatigue and emotional stress are also job problems that we are going to work on tonight. So we're going to, because of this, physical fitness is especially required for caregivers. So we want to make sure that we're physically fit. And first, we want to find out what is good health. And in a survey performed by Harvard University, we found that 95% of respondents defined good health as being when there's an absence of pain. But good health isn't just a lack of something. Instead, it's a positive state, one in which we are not only free of disease, but full of life energy. The World Health Organization defines health as a state of complete physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. So by this definition, good health means possessing mental and physical being and strong social connection with others. Good health starts with good physical health. What concrete actions can take you to improve your health and your physical health in the midst of your busy caregiving life? We find that the hardest part is committing to make your physical health a priority because you're so accustomed to taking care of other people, you tend to let yourself fall through the cracks, if you will. But once you've taken this important first step, the path to overall good health and vitality is simply about learning what to do and how to do it and having fun along the way. So we're going to start with exercise for the physical body. The most effective medication for many ailments isn't medication at all. It's actually exercise. And we've learned that exercise is the key to preventing much of the extra wear and tear that caregivers experience. And it provides us with an energy to handle our work without becoming ill. Incorporating physical exercise into your daily routine has many benefits that include lowering your blood pressure, raising high density lipoprotein, that's the good cholesterol, and levels of lowering low density lipoprotein, the bad cholesterol, as well as improving blood flow throughout the body and increasing the heart's working capacity. Conditions such as diabetes and arthritis can be managed, at least in part, by regular exercise. So with exercise, your bones can rebuild and repair themselves instead of becoming thin and porous, a condition you've heard of, I'm sure, as osteoporosis. And in some cases, exercise can actually eliminate the need for costly medications, which means no more unpleasant drug side effects. We all know the effects of that, how that feels. We've been there, I'm sure I have. New medical research suggests that physical exercise also encourages healthy brains to function at optimum levels. So fitness prompts nerve cells to multiply, strengthen their connections to each other, and protects them from harm. So exercise also positively affects our emotions. During exercise, our brain increases the production of hormones known as endorphins, which help us elevate mood and reduce feelings of fatigue. In other words, exercise can help us feel happier and calmer. Exercising regularly also helps us relieve stress and increase mental clarity because it provides a way for the body to release tension and pent-up frustrations. So exercising doesn't need to be excessively strenuous, complicated, or even time-consuming. 30 minutes of moderate activity a day is the goal. For some, spending this amount of time exercising each day is simply not possible because, and that's okay. I mean, we all can't fit it in, but there are ways around it. Studies have shown that 10-minute bursts of moderate activity done on a regular basis can make a difference. And this can include activities that are a part of your normal routine. The point is, anyone and everyone actually can increase his or her activity level in some ways. Throw out the excuses and open yourself up for the benefits of exercise. All right, getting started is our big obstacle. Many of us sit and wait for the right time, but that is something you have to put aside and just do it. You have to jump in, and once you've made the commitment to good health, it's time to make sure that you choose a plan of exercise that's right for you or that you will enjoy and stay with the long-term plan. So consider the following steps in creating a successful, enjoyable exercise plan. Remember, just take one extra step each day and you'll find yourself moving toward an improvement. It's easier than you think, really. Step one, talk with your doctor, especially if you've been physically inactive for some time or have any chronic illnesses. Let your doctor know your plans and make sure you are able to meet the demands of the plan you have chosen. Step two is choose activities that you will enjoy. If you can't bring yourself to continue with the exercises you choose, you will probably not reap the benefits. So think about the kinds of physical activities you enjoy, perhaps walking or swimming, tennis, dancing, gardening. Remember to keep it fun. Investigate the exercise programs that are available in your area for senior citizens, for senior centers rather, and then you may like look at the YMCA or decide if you want to exercise independently, a one-on-one with a trainer or in a class maybe. Be realistic in your expectations. Increase your exercise time slowly. For example, if you choose to walk for exercise, perhaps start with just a short walk around the yard before progressing to a walk around the block. Start with small increments of gentle activity and then increase as you feel stronger. Be aware of any discomfort or signs of overexertion, such as dizziness, and talk to your doctor if this happens. Drink plenty of water as you exercise, especially if the weather is warm, and avoid outdoor activities when the temperature is extremely warm or cold. Step number four, keep track of your progress. Studies have shown that if you keep a daily log of your activities, you'll be much more inclined to keep up with it because staying on track is your main objective. You might decide or designate rather an area in a journal or create a separate log book for just that purpose. You want to remember what you're doing and be able to look at it so that you know where you are. And you ask, well, what kind of exercise should you do? Well, keep in mind that your plan should incorporate exercises that work to enhance your endurance, your strength, your balance, and your flexibility. Endurance relates to one's overall physical condition. It's the ability to exert yourself for an extended period without growing fatigued. So while typical endurance-type exercises include running, swimming, bicycling, you can increase your physical endurance with any exercise as long as you gradually work to increase the length of time you do it. Strength exercises should build muscle, and strong muscles increase the amount of force you can exert for a given task. Keeping your muscles in shape helps prevent falls, which avoids problems such as broken hips. Consider adding weight to your routine. You don't need to use excessive weight or go out and buy dumbbells. Simply bottles of water, doing arm lifts while watching the news, for example, can be helpful. Balance is the ability to maintain your center of gravity and avoid falls. So strengthening your lower body muscles leads to greater stability and fewer falls. Flexibility involves freeing your range of physical motion, making it easier for you to reach down and tie your shoes or look over your shoulder when you look back at the car and you're trying to drive. Simple things we've learned that can just trigger a domino effect of problems. So the stronger we are with flexibility and we find ourselves not bending over to pick up something from the ground and are in pain for the next month with our back or something. So that's important. And exercise classes may be an option for you. Many people enjoy exercise classes for the chance to learn something new and to enjoy the support of the group. And there are many available. You can try things like bicycle, spin classes, dancing, options like Tai Chi yoga. Water exercises are particularly good because, well, they help with strength, flexibility, and balance. And they're especially helpful when relieving stress and learning to settle the mind. Tai Chi is literally means moving life force. This ancient form of exercise is becoming more and more popular because it's a gentle workout that leaves you feeling energized. Tai Chi challenges the mind as well as the body and is especially effective at reducing stress. So Tai Chi combines routines of deep breathing, posturing, stretching, swaying, and other controlled movements with meditation. The clothing is come as you are. And people of every size, shape, and fitness level can participate. So it might be something that fits you. A typical Tai Chi class progressively introduces the movements of a Tai Chi form. And you will gradually be introduced to more movements until you are accomplished in the entire series. Much like learning the steps of a dance, you'll note that no one seems to be exerting himself or herself. Is it really exercise, you might even ask, because it's such a non-exertion type of exercise. And by moving through the entire series of choreographed movements very slowly, in a state of absolute relaxation, you are virtually forced to let go of grudges, resentments, and anything that keeps you from connecting with your body. Tai Chi is also providing us with positive aspects of aerobic activity, such as increasing heart strength and overall energy. Researchers have found that Tai Chi is, with its emphasis on balance and controlled movements, decreases the incidence of the number of falls suffered by its practitioners, with some studies reporting a reduction by as much as 50%. Another benefit of Tai Chi is that It has an increased blood circulation, and which seems to help alleviate pains of arthritis. And Tai Chi is offered through private instructions, classes, books, and video. You can even go to YouTube if you like and put it in your, plug it into your TV screen and work out in front of your TV at home in the comfort of your own environment. So classes can be found through community centers, senior centers, health clubs, or even hospital-sponsored programs. If you are thinking of joining a class, ask questions of the instructor and participants to make sure that it's right for you, because how long has the instructor been teaching? Do other students like the class? What keeps them coming back? Take a test class if you'd like, maybe two if possible. And then most instructors will allow you to participate and get a feel for it before you actually sign up for the class. So there may be a minimal charge, but it's important that you feel comfortable with the teacher and like his or her style, because you want to make this a long adventure, not a one time or two time. You want something you can adjust to for long-term effect. Yoga is another possibility. It's one that unifies the body, the mind, and the spirit, and is a path to personal growth and healing. Its goal is to reach complete peace in mind and body. So there are many forms of yoga, each with a different focus, and you want something that's going to fit your general capabilities at the stage you're in. So yoga helps tone and strengthen muscles. It increases flexibility and encourages deep, even breathing. Studies have shown that it can relieve the symptoms of several common illnesses like arthritis, chronic fatigue, diabetes, asthma, and obesity. Like Tai Chi, yoga incorporates meditation for reducing stress and increasing everyday awareness of our bodies. A typical class might very well just involve stretching and relaxing breathing techniques. And students are instructed in various physical poses which vary in degree of difficulty. So an experienced instructor can tailor poses to your own personal abilities and limitations. Movements are typically slow and the class is quiet or accompanied by soft music to encourage a meditative state. Yoga is now available nearly everywhere, from gyms and special yoga centers to community centers and even hospitals. So you can also find guidance from video books, and the feedback and sociability of a class. As with other exercises, programs, you may find yourself considering, ask questions in advance. Is the class suitable for a beginner? Is the instructor knowledgeable about health conditions such as joint or back problems? Can he or she modify poses for you to prevent injury? So make sure you ask the right questions and get them, maybe write them on paper so that when you go into the class, you have your questions prepared. Water exercise is an ideal way. And in fact, the benefit of water exercise, not only terrific for anyone who's mobile issues, but many centers have a swing that will, you can sit in above the water and it will swivel around and lower you into the water. And I've actually seen this, and it's so much easier if you find maybe the YMCA. I know that is an option. They have these, so most of the ones with pools anyway, because water exercise makes a terrific workout for nearly anyone of any age and fitness level. Compared to exercising on land, water offers more resistance than air to your muscles, which also have to work against the body's natural tendencies to float in the water, creating a harder workout. So other benefits of water exercise include the ability to extend the limbs farther while underwater, increasing the range of motion, particularly good for arthritis, and a decreased risk of injury from falling, and less stress on the joints. New research also indicates that water exercise may be effective in fighting osteoporosis. As with any form of exercise, you will need to take some common sense precautions. Don't swim alone, use a flotation belt if there's a chance you can end up in the deep water and your swimming skills are limited. So stay hydrated. Wear water shoes to prevent traction, to improve traction on the floor and of the pool. So exercising with a loved one, because you don't want to exercise alone in the water. Just as we can benefit from exercising, so too can those with Alzheimer's disease and other neurological disorders. So it may take a little imagination to find activities both you and your challenged by and you can enjoy. So you have a shared experience can be a very welcome break from the daily do this, do that, all the caregiving requirements. You need some type of exercise that's going to give you a peace and not just as a workout, because you're demanding a lot of yourself in your caregiving routines, and you want to find a way to enjoy it. So exercising together can be incorporated into your daily caregiving routine, actually. Gardening, walking the dog, pushing the wheelchair around the block, or picking up trash can all be done as a duo. And the easiest, fastest, and most readily available physical activity for persons with a memory disorder is walking with someone else. You can take your loved one to the safe and climate-controlled environment of a shopping mall. Many malls have a wall walking area, a mall walking area that offers structure, incentives, and social opportunities. So such programs are perfect for the accomplished person with dementia or an accompanied person with a dementia. And other activities include hiking, dancing, tandem cycling, boating, and household tasks. And in addition to being an enjoyable way to spend time together while increasing your physical fitness, studies show that exercise reduces the frequency and unwanted behaviors of wandering, pulling at the clothes, making repetitive noises, swearing, and aggressive acts, like improving communication and social participation. So you want to avoid physical injury while caregiving, of course. And two main areas at the greatest risk for injury from physical caregiving activities are the lower back and the arms and shoulders. For caregiver in particular, there are two specific areas of improvement you should strive for if you're going to be responsible for the physical care of a loved one. The first is proper body mechanics, and the second is strengthening the back, shoulders, and neck muscles. Body mechanics refer to the way in which we move our bodies. It involves standing and moving in ways that prevent injury, avoiding fatigue, and making the best use of your strength when performing physical tasks. So when you move and learn how to move properly, control and balance with your own body, it's easier to move another person. And that's the beginning of a long-lasting relationship when you learn to work with what you have. So if you're having trouble getting started with your exercise program or keeping up with it, you have to be honest with yourself about why you're avoiding exercise. Is there a physical reason to go to the doctor and get your health in order so that you can maintain your fitness level? If you simply don't like exercising, you need to think about ways to increase your daily activities. Try more vacuuming. Window shop before filling your cart. If a lack of time is the problem, maybe you can work towards 10-minute exercise sessions instead of a longer session. If it's the cost, maybe you can set up a walking plan with some exercises at home and avoid fees charged by the gym. So if your caregiving duties keep you from leaving your loved one, maybe consider exercising together, because again, working as a duo is maybe your answer. Now, we said the body. We talked about exercise. Now, one that is easily ignored sometimes because we're in such a rush and are constantly caring for our loved one is nutrition. We need to take care of our body with good eating habits. So we want to talk about nutrition, and nutrition refers to the intake of nutrients such as carbohydrates, fats, protein, water, vitamins, and minerals that allow the body to grow and repair itself. Without proper nutrition, bodily processes such as creating energy and ridding the body of waste do not function adequately and can eventually lead to serious health problems. Getting proper nutrition while giving care to a loved one is often difficult. We understand that. But in some cases, the pressures of caregiving make it difficult to find time to plan, prepare, and eat meals regularly. So common among caregivers is drinking more alcohol than he or she normally would. So that actually blunts the appetite for nutrition foods. Combine these changes, lead to weight loss, a visible indication of the caregiver stress level. You notice the stress level decreasing as you eat better, along with your exercising and good nutrition. You need to keep in mind, however, not everyone who is poorly nourished will suffer a visible weight change. In some cases, weight may appear normal or even ideal, but nutritional quality is lacking. Nutrition and weight are not always the same thing. While society places tremendous emphasis on weight, overall nutritional status, weight, can suffer the effects of malnutrition due to poor food selection. Many caregivers are unaware of their risk for poor nutrition. An easy way to determine the state of your nutritional value, or nutritional well-being, if you will, is to take nutrition seriously and actually maybe even consult with a nutritionist to find out what's suited best for your specific needs combined with your medications and your lifestyle. So we want to concentrate on things that will help us and not dissuade us from continuing to eat well while exercising. Now, there's a word about water in this nutrition, and that's that drinking water is one of the most effective means of ensuring good health. Water maintains and regulates the body's systems and acts as a preventative measure against common disorders and illness. Our bodies use water for digestion, to absorb nutrients, for blood circulation, and for excreting waste. Water is a vital nutrient that the body cannot store for later use. That's why we need to constantly replenish our body's supply. To avoid dehydration, the body needs a minimum at least 6 or so glasses of 8 ounces daily. And the precise amount you need depends on your level of activity, the outside temperature and humidity level, the medications you take, illnesses, and the other foods you eat. Remember, if you're exercising, your daily need for water will increase. Normally, around 20% of the water we take in every day comes from food, while the rest comes from drinking water and beverages. And be wary of caffeinated beverages because they act as a bladder irritant, so causing increased urination and water loss. Try to balance your caffeinated beverages and the intake of them, rather, because drinking an equal amount of water during the day with the caffeine that you intake is important. And if you find it hard to drink enough water each day, consider eating foods with higher water content, such as fruits. Always avoid drinking water at the beginning of meals as it works to suppress the appetite. Fruits and vegetables are a good source also. An important point to make about this food category, though, is one can't be substituted for the other. The guideline is indicate that a healthy diet includes 5 servings a day of both fruits and vegetables. And there's a tendency among many to eat more fruits instead of vegetables and only 5 instead of 10 servings. So be aware that it's very little difference in the nutritional quality of fruits and vegetables. If you're eating them raw or even cooked, there's very little difference. Eat them. That's the most important thing. Fresh, frozen, canned, or dried, whole, or cut up, or mashed, they are all very similar. The important thing is to getting 10 servings, no matter how you slice it. That's the goal. So whole grains can either be refined or whole. You want refined grains have been milled and no longer contain the bran or germ that contain dietary fiber, iron, and many B vitamins. So consuming foods rich in fiber, such as whole grains, reduces the risk of coronary heart disease and may reduce constipation. Whole grains also are high on the list. So you want to make sure maybe a nutritionist is your best route, because you want to cater it to your specific needs. And vitamins and minerals are substitutes that your body needs in small quantities in order to function properly. In most cases, your body does not take the vitamin or mineral it needs, so they must be consumed on a regular basis. For healthy adults who get a balanced diet, the evidence is split on the benefits of vitamins and supplementation. So it's felt that anyone who can't match the recommendations of food pyramid use a daily supplement, typically eating fewer than 1,600 calories per day, and vegetarians will have a difficulty matching the requirements and should use supplements. Because of their unique needs, all caregivers who are 65 years of age or older should discuss the need for supplement with your healthcare provider. Now, we want to talk about what is good for us, and what we find for most of us is that our appetite decreases as we age. And a simple explanation is that we use less energy as we age, so the total number of calories we need for daily living also decreases. For example, a woman's caloric intake of 1,800 calories a day by age 75 is a big reduction from when she was 25, consuming 2,200 calories a day. But it's critical to understand that despite the changes in our appetite over time, the nutritional needs of the body does not decrease. We still need the same proteins, carbohydrates, vitamins, and minerals that we've always needed. So we want to keep a tab on that, and that's where the journal comes in. Now, for the body, we certainly want to keep our body fitness intact. So we want to recognize that staying mentally active, beginning in adolescence and continuing through adulthood, lowers the rate of memory decline and improves the quality of the way we think. This quality, known as brain fitness, refers to how well our brains take in and process information from various sources, the way in which we use our cognitive processes to evaluate that information, and how we respond to the information that has been processed. A simple example, seeing a red light, the information is received. Recognizing that a red light means stop, that's understanding the action needed. And when we, you know, it tells us when and how to apply that break. That's responding appropriately to the information we've processed. So brain fitness is valuable for other reasons too. First, the thinking we do on a day-to-day basis, both consciously and unconsciously, helps keep our bodies functioning well. An example is eating and drinking. The natural signals our bodies send to us in response to hunger and thirst allow us to know when it's time to eat or drink, without taking time to think about it. It's a natural reaction, just an involuntary, if you will. Excuse me. And second, the brain fitness allows us to feel confident about making decisions, both the mundane decisions of daily routine and the more challenging ones that caregivers must face. Ultimately, maintaining a high level of brain fitness allows us to live well and maintain our independence throughout our lives. The brain ages, and in some respects, the brain continues to function as it always has, regardless of how old you are. You can expect abilities known as preserved functions to remain sharp for your entire life. Preserved functions include attention span, watching a television program or reading a book. And there's remote memory, remembering your wedding day, for example. Everyday communication skills, social greetings, telephone etiquette. And then there's visual perception, the ability to understand what you're seeing. And then there's the knowledge of syntax, understanding written and spoken language. And some functions in every brain are affected by age, known as declining functions. These are the annoying glitches in memory, attention, and the ability we all know as senior moments. Examples, the speed of processing memories, like, what's that person's name? Or you might, I can't remember that name, but then later in the dinner, of course, it'll hit you all of a sudden, like, oh, George, that's the person's name. Okay, that's kind of normal. Fluency, coming to a dead stop in the middle of a sentence and searching for a word. All right, noticing or naming objects. You ask someone, can you find that thing over the, then you can't quite place your name on it, like the remote. You're looking for the remote or your keys. So cognitive flexibility, that's the difficulty learning new words and like, or new tasks, like learning how to operate your new iPhone or your new Galaxy phone or new devices. The complexity of that can be challenging. So we then move on to complex logical analysis following multi-step processes such as balancing a checkbook. Then we have selective attention, which is multitasking. That becomes more difficult with age. And then you have to ask, is it normal aging or memory loss, a memory disorder, if you will? Because as we get older, we all dread those senior moments that we've talked about here. And what we want to do is, in these momentary lapses in memory, is it just normal aging, or is there a sign that something more serious is happening? And the answer is, it all depends. First, it's vital to understand that Alzheimer's disease, for example, is a disease, and it's vastly different having a normal 80-year-old brain that may take longer to retrieve the name of acquaintances from the memory bank, a phenomenon known as age-related memory loss or decline. These transient memory lapses are not the same as losing the ability to make memories. They are instead an indication of a slowing ability to retrieve memories. One of the first symptoms of the presence of Alzheimer's disease is often memory loss. However, to be truly an Alzheimer's disease is not just age-related decline. There must be an indication of a decline in a more than just memory retrieval. Examples include the loss of an understanding of the date and time, or loss of language abilities. The changes must progress over time, and they must impair your ability to function on a day-to-day basis. If you or a loved one is concerned that what you're experiencing may be something more than merely a normal slowing down of abilities, take your concerns to your doctor. That's a good start. Because caregivers in the senior moment syndrome is real. So you as a caregiver, must be as intellectually alert as possible, particularly when called on to make decisions for the person you're caring for, because the stress and anxiety together with the poor eating habit and disruptions in sleep that can come from caring for a loved one can cause decline in brain fitness. And in some cases, inattention or distraction can make it difficult to think clearly. Here's an example. The phone rings. It's the adult daycare center changing the time of the caregiver's potluck dinner from 6 p.m. to 5 p.m. So during the conversation, your loved one calls from the other room asking for help getting a book down from a high shelf. At the same time, the kitchen timer goes off telling you that the casserole is ready. You hang up the phone and help your loved one retrieve the book. And while you're doing so, you realize your loved one needs to change for dinner, rather. And unfortunately, you forget about the casserole until it's too late. Combine these day-to-day factors with other illnesses that can affect memory and thinking, and it becomes clear why caregivers are at an increased risk for problems and thinking with and memory that are known as the senior moment syndrome. While it does not usually signify a future disease, it can be extremely frustrating, especially as you are trying to keep straight the details and demands of your loved one's care. So how do you combat senior moment syndrome? A brain fitness routine is a good start. And There's good evidence that brain exercise is helpful. Some of the forgetful loss of mental acuity that comes with aging are caused, at least in part, by non-use. So seniors engaged in mentally stimulating activities have been shown to have lower rates of developing dementia. Researchers have found that among leisure activities, reading, playing board games, playing musical instruments, or dancing even, were associated with a reduced risk of dementia. And just as a program for physical fitness includes a variety of exercises, brain fitness is most successful if you pay attention to the right mix of exercises that help the brain stay fit and functional. And as you think about planning your own brain fitness program, remember there are four key factors. You want to relax. Relaxation has been shown to help keep thinking clear in older adults, as it does people of all ages. One way to relax is through meditation, which works to lower stress levels and which leads to better brain function, even as your days get more stressful. Daily prayer, if you will, or journaling can also be effective. And number two, you want to keep moving. Physical activity can keep your brain working in top form. Part of the benefit comes from improved blood circulation that encourages the growth of new brain cells by increasing oxygen flow to your brain. And that same circulation boosts other growth factors, such as what is known as brain-derived neuropathic factor. And that helps us grow new nerve cells to survive. So finally, it's believed that exercise increases the levels of some of the neurotransmitters in the brain that play a key role in thinking. Number three, don't retire from life. Do you know the definition of retire is? It's to withdraw or go away or apart to a place of privacy, shelter, or seclusion. Don't do it. Don't do it. Or if you do retire, don't put down your intellect and pick up the remote. Bad choice. Researchers have found that cognitive active seniors were 2.5 times less likely to develop dementia than those who were less active intellectually. Even with the same pressures and time demands of caregiving, you need to find time to stay engaged with the outside world. Learning new things, such as playing a musical instrument is great for that, and a foreign language maybe, or some effective way of keeping your mind intellectually fit. And number four, socialize. The well-known saying, united we stand, divided we fall, is never more true than when it's applied to caregivers. Social isolation is a common occurrence among caregivers, given the time that is required to give proper and care to a loved one. So it makes sense that you're not going to socialize as much. So going to the corner store can become a major undertaking. Dining out with friends becomes difficult as the behaviors of your loved one become unpredictable. Often the response to these circumstances is to stay at home, resist that urge and cancel. You don't want to cancel. Resist the urge to cancel your plans to attend that group support. It's necessary. Don't rely on the neighbor to pick up a few things for you that you need at the store. In each instance, your interaction with the world around you diminishes. So it's important for you to get out and remain active. While these changes may seem minor, the loss of social activities can be dangerous to your health. Since medical research has shown that the more social activities a caregiver is involved with, the less likely he or she will have the symptoms of depression. And as we discussed earlier, depression makes it difficult to think clearly, efficiently, and contributes to the senior moment syndrome. The benefits of brain fitness pay off. So you want to understand that for the weary and worried caregiver, the 10-minute a day brain fitness is for you. You definitely want to get at least 10 minutes a day in, neurologically, mentally, because keeping the brain physically fit is as important as your body's physical fitness. And then there's good sleep as well. So we want to get sleep to work on our body. And we know that everyone loves to sleep, but sleep is more than just a relaxing activity. Our bodies need it to rest each day to restore and grow, leaving us refreshed and ready for the next day. When we find ourselves being interrupted in our sleep, we feel it right away. You miss one day of sleep and mental processes become less efficient and your mood in general can become depressed. For caregivers, issues such as the uncertainty of the future, the difficulty in finding help, and the inability to understand options for treatment all add up to the great deal of anxiety during the day. At night, when it's time for the body and mind to calmly drift into sleep, these issues can create a number of different sleep-related problems. Chronic sleep deprivation robs us of emotional and physical well-being, and in turn limits our ability to interact well with our loved one. Like that leads us to insomnia. So in general, insomnia is the inability to fall asleep or to remain asleep throughout the night. The most common forms of insomnia are when a person can't fall asleep at the beginning of the night, or it takes a long time, more than 30 or 45 minutes, to fall asleep. It can come after a sleep interruption, where a person wakes up many times each night and can't fall back to sleep so easily. Others find waking up easily and being unable to get back to sleep is a major problem. And then finally, there are those who have a general sense of waking up feeling tired and then remaining that way for most of the day. So all these forms of insomnia can be caused by many things, including emotionally charged circumstances, such as losing a loved one, or a lifestyle issue, such as drinking alcohol or caffeine. Insomnia can be caused by a number of factors and sometimes by combination of them. So among caregivers, it's very common for insomnia to be brought on by stress. And since anxiety over day-to-day or long-term concerns may keep a caregiver's mind too alert, that prevents sleep. Depression can also be a factor. It's as if it causes a chemical change in the brain, and that may affect sleeping habits. Medications can cause insomnia too. Many over-the-counter medications, including some decongestants and weight loss products, contain caffeine and other stimulants. Antihistamines, for example, like Benadryl, may initially cause grogginess, which can promote falling asleep, but they can worsen urinary problems, causing sleep interruptions. And they're especially hard on older adults and can lead to confusion as well. If you have been having symptoms for more than a month or so, you feel that you need to take an over-the-counter medication to help you get some sleep, you should probably speak with your doctor, because he or she can review a long list of possible causes and recommend treatment options. And as we get older, the more difficult it becomes to get a good night's rest, even though the total sleep we need stays about the same. Older adults experience changes in their sleep cycle that impact nighttime routines. For example, more time is spent in lighter stages of sleep than in the deep stages of sleep, called non-REM sleep, which is the time during the sleep cycle when restoration sleep occurs. So because you're sleeping more lightly, you're also more likely to wake up to a physical discomfort, such as having to go to the bathroom or an aching back or neck, for example. You also have consequences of aging. Is that your internal clock? The natural signal your body gives you to let you know that it's time to sleep. It tends to advance. So you're tired earlier and in the evening, and consequently you wake up earlier in the morning. So we want to keep track of this, and ideally you've started a journal at this point, not only of your exercise routine and your diet, and now we want to journal our sleep patterns so that we can identify changes and find ways to keep it, the what works for us working. And in addition to the psychological changes, there are other changes that can impact our sleep in older caregivers. As an older caregiver, you may not be able to participate in the leisure sports or fitness activities you used to. And physical activity helps promote a good night's sleep. In other cases, a health condition can disrupt sleep. The chronic pain and conditions such as arthritis or back problems or neck problems, as well as depression, anxiety, and stress can all interfere with sleep. Older men can even develop enlargement of the prostate gland. So that can cause the need to urinate frequently, interrupting sleep. In women, hot flashes and that accompany menopause can be equally disruptive. You discover the problem, and to get to the bottom of what's causing your sleep disturbance, a good place is to start with the sleep diary, like we just talked about. So you get that started, because keeping track of the details of how you sleep, such as the time you're going to sleep, seems to interrupt what seems to interrupt your sleep, and how much you're sleeping during the day can help you identify problems that may be causing your sleep trouble. Your doctor ultimately may be able to look over the diary and think about medications for factors related to your medical history that might be causing your problem. As you're waiting to talk to your doctor, be careful about choosing an over-the-counter medication. Older caregivers should be wary of the PM types of preparations, the PM whatever you choose, because since the active ingredient in, say, for example, Benadryl, produces side effects that may include confusion and urinary retention, all prescription sleep aids induce gait instability because of drowsiness. For older adults who need to use the bathroom at night, this can increase the risk of falling. For all ages, there's the potential for dependency on the medication as well as continuing drowsiness throughout the day. So that impairs your skilled mental and physical activities. For a good night's sleep, there's a payoff. As a well-rested, physically fit caregiver, you're stronger and more effective. Your emotional stability brings greater peace and well-being to your family. Your loved one can sense the gentler environment and become less tense. So not only are you able to provide better care, but your body is functioning more easily with greater energy. You feel your zest for life, if you will, returning your brain to firing faster and able to handle the many decisions and demands required of you as a caregiver become a little easier. And so before your mind is free to become more energized, you may have to get through some of the emotional hurdles that complicate your days as a caregiver. And we know what that means. That means reducing stress by any means possible. For the first hour now, we've talked about the body. And if you need to rewind if you're listening to an archived show, do so, because I've given you a lot of information just now. And it's time for a little break. When we come back after the break, we're going to start the second part of the show, the second half of the show, with the mind. And that's where we're going to get into sincerely deep conversation. So I've given you a lot. Take a deep breath. And if you need to take notes, get your pad out, because as we go into the next hour, we're going to discuss depression and anxiety, denial and guilt, and then anger. So we're going to take a break now, have a music break, get up, stretch your legs, stretch your arms, reach to the sky, and come back and listen to the music while you're gone. Meanwhile, At Home by Rat Bat Blue. Rat Bat Blue. Check them out on YouTube. Meanwhile, At Home, we'll be back after the song for the second half of Surviving Head Trauma with Terry Smith.
Baby, here looking at your picture. I wonder if you ever get your head together. I wonder if you'll ever find a way back, baby, to your smile. Taking back your lunges at his heart.
Rat Bat Blue, Meanwhile at Home, I'd Do Anything for You. And that's kind of what we're talking about tonight, what we would do for our loved ones. And if you're caregiving for a loved one, you know what that means. And we find ourselves being so concerned about our loved ones and absorbed in their well-being that sometimes we let ourselves fall by the wayside. So that's what we're concentrating on tonight, our topic, caring for caregivers of trauma. Because our caregivers are really the most valuable players, the MVPs of this journey. Because without caregivers, those with trauma really, I mean, doctors are good, but something like the caregiver who is the personal one at home, because that's where we find the most connection. You don't connect as much with a clinical person or clinician as much as your loved one, nor will you get as drained as much, because your clinicians go. They see you, they treat you, and they're gone. Caring for someone, a loved one you're with, is most challenging, and I like to say a special love for Bill, and you know who you are. We're all going through a lot with caregiving, and caring for our loved ones, but it's imperative that we maintain our own health, because there are so many states of this journey, so many phases that can be draining and debilitating. So we've talked about maintaining the mind, I mean the body. We're going to cover the mind in this next hour, the last hour of the show, this episode, caring for caregivers of trauma. And with that in mind, I'd like to get started. And we want to talk about, in this segment, depression, anxiety, denial, guilt, and anger. And we're going to start with grief, because grief is a healthy state when it comes to coping with painful changes in our lives. It allows us grief is a healthy, it's healthy when it comes to helping us deal with the changes in our lives, allowing us to heal from loss and embrace new reality. So a healthy grief releases feelings rather than keeping them bottled up inside and lets us move forward in life with renewed vitality. The ideal result of grief is to achieve closure and an end to our feelings of loss or pain. However, when closure is not reached within a reasonable amount of time, normal grief can become depression. And depression is all-consuming. Coping with a loved one's dementia or Alzheimer's or severe TBI or whatever neurological dysfunction, strokes, it demands a great deal from caregivers. So who they're too often struggling to make do with a strong support system in place to help. You don't have that. It's going to lead to more severe problems. So caregivers are forced to let go of a loved one little by little and again, sometimes the pain can span for many years, and grief over these losses is often experienced over and over. The grief associated with caregiving is uniquely burdensome. Often when illness and subsequent death strike, a caregiver must face not only the loss of that loved one, but the loss of control and loss of independence, as well as the possible loss of his or her job or plans for the future. So this experience may explain why caregivers are more likely to suffer from symptoms of depression. While feeling a sadness associated with grief lessens with time, depression can dim the joy for life for months, even years. Some even longer. So people who have experienced depression are familiar with the disabling heaviness in which it's markedly different than normal sadness. Depressive illness is not just about having the blues for too long. It interferes with daily life and causes pain and suffering not only for those who have the disorder, but for those around them. And grieving, you might be fairly dysfunctional for a short period of time, unwilling to do the things you might normally do. However, a person experiencing healthy grief recognizes that life does go on and eventually seeks to move forward with energy and healing. Clinical depression, on the other hand, lasts without relief. It sinks into you and prevents you from moving forward in life. You might instead obsess about the perceived futility of life and not even take the comfort from talking with others. Depression may isolate you entirely, and in isolation, depression deepens. You may feel exhausted, worthless, helpless, and hopeless. Negative views that typically do not accurately reflect the actual circumstances of your life. The dangers of depression is physical as well as mental. So caregivers who suffer from depression tend to have weakened immune systems and an increased chance of developing chronic illnesses. Depression can increase the risk of osteoporosis and high blood pressure, and can also increase levels of stress hormones, such as adrenaline and cortisol, which can, over the long run, increase the risk of heart disease and digestive problems. It can even shrink the hippocampus, which is the area of the brain involved with learning and memory. So because of the toll depression takes on caregivers and those around them, it's important to recognize the warning signs of depression and understand how they differ and necessary and healthy grieving. So what do we do to treat depression? How do we treat, we say, some people say that you can't just snap out of it, and you, chances are, won't be able to just snap out of it and feel better spontaneously, nor is recovery from clinical depression a matter of willpower. However, the disease is highly treatable with competent care. Finding help requires seeking help. Your doctor is an invaluable resource when it comes to obtaining effective treatment. Unfortunately, many times a doctor will miss the signs of depression in caregivers. Being a caregiver is a red flag for depression. Yet only a third of all physicians inquire of their caregiver patients about depression. It's easier, after all, to limit an examination to questions about blood pressure or diabetes. Caregivers need to be proactive about depression. They must bring up concerns or questions about with their doctors. Otherwise, unexpressed feelings and concerns accompanied by a sense of isolation can worsen the depression, creating a vicious cycle of increasing isolation and pain. Caregivers who are clinically depressed often think they just need to take a break and take a short time off from their duties, rather. And often they return to find themselves in the same situation that caused the depression in the first place. So in order to become truly overcome clinical depression, rather, is psychological issues must be dealt with. Generally, though, counseling, depression can result in chemical imbalances in the brain, which can be addressed with medications called antidepressants. In many cases, these medications can help a person feel better, but do not eliminate the cause of depression. Thus, like aspirin, antidepressants can reduce symptoms while leaving the cause of the pain untreated. For example, antidepressants can lift the dark, heavy moods of depression, but a caregiver will still need to address the difficulties at home in order to recover thoroughly. The degree of improvement from a little relief from the symptoms to complete remission depends on a variety of factors related to the individual and the severity of the depression being treated. The length of time one continues with antidepressant medication treatment is largely determined by the individual and his or her level of depression, rather than the situation that may have triggered the disease. Typically, a doctor will prescribe medications for 6 to 12 months and then stop the treatment to see how a person responds. Frequently, some resolution has occurred in this time and further treatment is unnecessary. Many depressed people need medication for just a single period, such as this, and then never have to take it again. For some depressions, however, medication may have to be taken intermittently or perhaps indefinitely. Like any medication, antidepressants do not produce the same effect in everyone. Some people may respond better to one medication than another. Some may need larger doses than others. Some experience annoying side effects while others do not. Age, sex, body size, body chemistry, physical illnesses, and their treatments, diet, habits such as smoking, are some of the factors that can influence a medication's effect. So sometimes it takes several attempts to find the type of medication and counseling that work best, and it's essential to work with your doctor to find effective treatment. Physicians will recommend a particular antidepressant based on the symptoms that are present. Relief does not come immediately. It usually takes between 1 and 3 weeks for changes to occur. Some symptoms of depression diminish early with treatment. Others take a while longer to respond. For instance, energy level or sleeping and eating patterns may improve before the depressed mood lifts. If there's a little or no change in symptoms after 5 to 6 weeks, a different medication may be needed. So when searching for an effective medication, it's crucial to work closely with your physician and communicate regularly with him or her about any effects or lack of effects you might experience. What will you be like freed from depression? Well, freed from depression, you are better able to adapt to the constant changes in your loved one's condition, and you're better equipped to think more realistically about your situation. Without depression, you'll be more calm and accepting with your loved one. Without depression, it's easier for you to see the degenerative disease as a separate entity from your loved one. When your loved one becomes mentally or physically aggressive, as is common, without depression, you're more likely to find positive ways to handle the situation rather than responding in kind with increasing the struggle. In kind as in respond to your loved one, in kind as in the same way they respond to you, you do the same with them, and it becomes a debilitating cycle, a relentless give and take, tit for tat. Without depression, you can make better judgments and handle day-to-day tasks more easily and manage future planning with greater clarity and sounder decisions. Without depression, you can pay better attention to your own health issues and wellness, such as healthy eating and exercise, finding the social support, and taking more opportunities for rejuvenation. You can provide greater quality of care to your loved one as well. And studies have been shown that a loved one with a strong and healthier caregiver actually manages his or own disease better in the long run. When you're free of depression, you can also find warmth and love in the process of caregiving. Every day provides an opportunity to connect with others, to find some moments of beauty in life, or to be grateful for life itself. Being beyond depression, there may still be grief and difficulty, but there's also plenty of great joy. So we want to do our best to do that, and that involves seeking medical attention. That's fine. It's do that, whatever it takes, because we need to get over that for the reasons I just listed here. But we then talk about anxiety, which is a part of the depression angle here. Unhealthy anxiety is a constant and overwhelming feeling of apprehension, fear or worry. Most of us have heard of the fight or flight response. When our nervous system shifts into higher gear in order to deal with danger, this response is literally a lifesaver when it functions properly, causing our hearts to pump faster, our breathing to quicken, and our blood pressure to increase in order to make more oxygen available to us so that we can run faster or fight more fiercely. So when we experience this in normal life, we are motivated to protect ourselves and our loved ones and can respond faster to threats, such as when a car pulls in front of us suddenly. But when that response gets out of control, our bodies get plummeted by stress hormones and suffer negative consequences. Stress kills. I mean, chronic unchecked stress can lead to such serious conditions as heart attacks and strokes. There's an increasing evidence that stress is also a contributing factor to other illnesses, such as rheumatoid arthritis, diabetes, frequent colds, or respiratory infections. If you're constantly on alert, as we are when anxious, we are depleting our energy sources and compromising our immune system. Effectively managing our stress can be a powerful weapon against anxiety or serious illness. This is a good question you can ask yourself. Do you find yourself getting anxious whenever your loved one is out of sight? Are you awake listening to them all night, fearing the worst? Are you up in the middle of the night wondering about tomorrow, unable to return to sleep? Are you frequently irritable and quick to snap at those around you? Do you jump at sudden noises? Do your thoughts run away with you, making it difficult to stay on task or focus clearly? It can be difficult to tell if your level of anxiety is too high. A good rule of thumb is to honestly consider how much it impairs your life or keeps you from doing things that you once liked doing. Anxiety often becomes a problem after a prolonged period of extreme stress and dramatic change, such as receiving a memory disorder diagnosis. Too much stress and anxiety can seriously affect our ability to focus on coping skills. We feel anxious because we are stressed, and we are stressed even more by our anxiety. And unless we know how to manage anxiety, it can become a chronic condition. Here's the thing. Take a look at the list that I'm about to read to you. So maybe get a pad and or if you can rewind this, check it out. But here's a list that I prepared for you. And it's take a look at the following list. Palpitations, sweating, trembling, shortness of breath, a sense of choking, chest pain, dizziness, feeling detached, a fear of dying, numbness or tingling, chills or hot flashes, nausea. If you frequently experience three or more of these symptoms for 6 months or more at a time, you may have an anxiety disorder. Sometimes we're unaware of our anxiety, but usually know we feel fatigued or nervous more often than we'd like to feel. So anxiety, like any psychological disorder, is simply a signal that something is out of balance and needs our attention. Now, treating anxiety. Treatments used to resolve anxiety include medications, cognitive behavioral therapy, lifestyle changes, and stress management techniques. But no matter how we approach our healing, we must commit to it in order to transform our anxious, fear-ridden experience into one of greater peace, strength, and energy. Medication. Most anxiety disorders are not solely psychological, but also have a biological component that often responds to medications which help repair mood-affecting chemical imbalances in the brain. The benefits of these medications appear to be limited to the time when they are actively being taken. So for this reason, medications are often prescribed for just a short period of time to ease the immediate symptoms of anxiety and facilitate counseling. Therapy. All right. Most patients with anxiety disorders will be best treated with cognitive behavioral therapy, often in combination with medication. Cognitive behavioral therapy works on the principle that our thoughts influence the way we feel and behave. In other words, an anxious person interprets certain situations as dangerous, causing anxiety symptoms and a desire to escape. So when our loved one becomes verbally aggressive, we might think, I'm a terrible caregiver, or that's why that person is upset with me. So this thought leads us to feel badly about ourselves and our situations and creates more anxiety. We would have a very different reaction to the same event if we thought instead, this is the disease talking. I know I'm doing the best I can. Cognitive behavioral therapy teaches you to change the way you think in order to change how you feel. This doesn't mean that it's all in your head, but rather it means that you can learn new sets of skills and techniques to gain more control over your feelings and how you react in various situations. Lifestyle changes can help us recover from anxiety, and exercise is a powerful tool that can be used to overcome both anxiety and depression, and offers many other benefits as well, like a healthy diet along with exercise promotes optimal brain health, which directly impacts our emotional well-being. Cutting down on substances such as caffeine and alcohol is a sure way to turn the odds in our favor. And it is important throughout the caregiving journey to monitor our stress levels. When we're overwhelmed but tempted to just deal with it without taking concrete steps to reduce our stress, it negatively affects those we care for as well as ourselves. The symptoms of anxiety are the body's way of letting us know it needs to relax. When our bodies are relaxed, we can cope better with our lives. Learn to deal with stress by practicing the techniques which can relax your mind and body regardless of external events. In addition to getting enough rest and relaxation, exercising and following a healthy diet, techniques for imagery, meditation, and progressive muscular relaxation are effective tools for releasing stress. Sex is actually a good tool as well. Imagery is a potent method of stress reduction, especially when combined with physical relaxation methods such as deep breathing. The idea behind the use of imagery is that you can create a very relaxing situation in your mind, which will settle your anxiety and help calm yourself. The more intensely you imagine the situation, the more relaxing the experience will be. Meditation is a useful and practical technique for managing stress, with strong physiological and physical benefits. It can help rest your body, allow stress hormones to subside, and occupy your mind so that unpleasant, stressful thoughts do not intrude. There are many forms of meditation, all of which can be learned on your own and practiced almost anywhere. The actual practice can range from sustaining one thought to simply paying attention to our thought habits. One of the most common forms of meditation is breath practice, which involves sitting quietly and paying attention to your breathing. Progressive muscular relaxation is useful for relaxing tense muscles, and the effort can also help induce a greater state of calm. The idea is that by tensing your muscles first, you are able to relax them even more than you would otherwise. So other tried techniques include reducing anxiety through quiet exercise, such as Tai Chi yoga, like we talked about earlier, journaling, allowing yourself to cry, talking to a trusted friend about your feelings and fears, enjoying a good book, a hot bath, or listening to soothing music. I played Rat Bat Blue tonight, but find the music that soothes you. Use it. Find other music like that. Use it. Find what comforts you, soothes you. Use it. Managing your anxiety, there's a payoff. Being free of anxiety doesn't mean that you're not worrying about your loved one. It means the worry isn't taking over your life. It's not keeping you from finding the good in all your hard work. Free from the draining effects of anxiety, you feel more relaxed and calm. You're more capable of handling the surprises and challenges that caregiving throws at you. Sleep isn't as difficult, and you're less anxious. Has a positive effect on the moods of those around you. Without punishing effects of depression and anxiety, you are coming closer to being truly energized. Now, we've gotten to the phase of denial and guilt. Denial and guilt. Now, this is going to be an interesting one. So brace yourself here. Let's get ready to go to experience life. And we know that that's going to require constant change. Life is constantly changing. The only constant in life is change. So change can sometimes be frightening and painful. And some of the hardest changes we'll ever deal with come when a loved one is diagnosed with some type of neurological disorder, like Alzheimer's or severe TBI or stroke or whatever the neurological disorder is. It means they cannot function as they once did, cannot be dependent upon to be the same person we've always known, and may not even remember us for very much longer. So to the caregiver, facing these changes means giving up familiar routines, adapting to increasing limitations, and most of all, letting go of someone we love. Little by little, it's a difficult process that frequently makes it harder by two internal obstacles, denial and guilt. Let's start with denial. And with denial, we, as caregivers, our lives sometimes seem to be running us rather than the other way around. So we want to feel in control again. At first, we might deny that the disease even exists. We might avoid getting a diagnosis. We might keep to rigid routines and refuse to make way for the unplanned and unwanted course of the disease, all in an effort to prevent it from becoming reality. And in the end, resisting only increases our suffering and keeps us from real happiness and inner peace. Denial, a natural response to the fear of change, is one of the primary ways we resist the all-important acceptance of reality and complicate our already complicated lives. So denial is often turned to in times of great stress. When our lives take a sudden turn for the worse, when tragedy comes into our homes and threatens our way of life, when we're faced rather with any serious loss, we might choose denial as a way of coping. Denial screens out information we aren't prepared to accept. So here, Elizabeth Ross, for example, she's an eminent psychiatrist and the author of On Death and Dying. She lists a denial as one of the five stages of grief a person passes through in accepting the death of a loved one, as with when a parent on being informed of an accident of a child will say, "No, no, you must have the wrong address. It can't be the baby. No, you know, this kind of denial is usually short-term, eventually discard it when the person has had time to deal with the new reality. In this form, it is a natural and important coping mechanism in tragic situations. Short-term denial can occur on a small scale, blurring over an unsettling event or change so that we don't quite see it in its frightening entirety. We have no need really to accept it as it is, such as our loved one's failure to remember us. Or it can occur on a very large scale, such as when we deny the existence of the disease entirely. We may choose to believe that the disease was misdiagnosed, is not so serious, or that our loved one seems to be improving. When we use denial as a way of coping temporarily, it can be a lifesaver to give us time to gain enough strength to face that reality. But when denial prevents us from facing reality for an extended period of time or hinders us from taking action when needed, it's considered unhealthy and even dangerous. Caregivers might live in denial for their true feelings. So you may want to think of yourself as a nice, loving husband or spouse, when in reality, you're angry or hurt by the gradual loss of your loved one, but you're unwilling to accept such negative feelings about yourself, so you deny their existence entirely. Denial is different than consciously lying about our feelings. It goes deeper. With denial, we're lying to ourselves about denying reality. So denial goes beyond blinders and makes us deaf as well. We rarely hear what others are trying to tell us. If confronted by our denial, we might respond with shock and indignation. We can believe that we are fine when everyone and everything around us suggests otherwise. We need to wake up from denial. Denial can come in three stages. I mean, what we call negotiation, education, and resolution. First, we recognize that the denial exists and we must want to break free from it. This is not as simple as it sounds, but we may find that we prefer denial to facing reality. If we have emotions that we don't want or we don't wish to have, giving up denial means we have to experience those unwanted emotions. But once we educate ourselves and accept that denial is not an effective way to deal with reality, that it actually increases our pain and misery. We learn that there are better ways to cope. We then realize that resolving denial is an important step towards living a full and satisfying life. Guilt. There we are. Guilt. It's something that's kind of written into the script that we've been given, and on some level, you may even feel responsible for the disease affecting your loved one. You may feel that perhaps you didn't catch it early enough, that you didn't love your parents or spouse as much as you thought you did when they were healthy. So you may berate yourself for your perceived failures rather than focusing on the good you achieved. If this is the case, you're suffering from one of the most common and one of the most debilitating emotional difficulties faced by caregivers, and that's guilt. Guilt is a paralyzing emotion arising from your inability to accept oneself or a situation. And it can lead to frustration, depression, other emotional problems. So guilt is usually a negative focus upon yourself. I'm an evil person. I can't bear myself. I'm unworthy. At its core, guilt is linked to low self-esteem. We believe we are wrong or bad in some way, that we aren't good enough or doing enough and aren't feeling the way we should or simply aren't good enough. Those are not rational feelings that should not dissuade us from finding proper ways. So unhealthy guilt that lingers without resolution only causes anxiety and hinders our ability to live our life in peace, to make sound decisions and deliver quality care. We must be able to distinguish between legitimate guilt and that motivates us to do better and harmful guilt that might be undeserved, that leaves us dispirited and ultimately incapable of doing all we can for our loved ones. So caregivers are prone to guilt for many reasons. Few people fully understand the complexities of the health problems suffered by our loved ones, or the insurance coverage, senior housing, drug plans, Medicare, legal and other senior-related issues that need to be faced. And we sometimes make mistakes or simply feel incompetent, both of which lead to guilt. If we are caring for a parent and we're not prepared for the changes in roles and the new responsibilities the job brings, uninformed friends may, and family even, may help to offer, but often their attempts serve to highlight our lack of confidence and shortcomings, which make us feel guilty. Others might want to impose guilt upon us or the caregiver. Real or perceived failures in our caregiving obligations can lead to criticism, though the criticism is often from family members who do far less than we do, but who want to pass their guilt on. Conquering guilt. We conquer it. Leaving guilt behind ultimately means accepting who you are and where you are in life. If you don't, you are simply not able to take care of your loved ones or yourself effectively. You must feel confident that you've done the best you can. You need to practice accepting who you are and valuing yourself enough to overcome the guilt of perceived inadequacy. Perfectionism and the need to be in control may be major roadblocks to overcoming guilt. So you may need to learn to let go of these tendencies first. But there's no easy way for guilt, no quick fix, no quick remedy. Freeing yourself from guilt is an ongoing process, one that you must attend to every day so that you can successfully reclaim your life or your energy. Ways in which you can facilitate this process may include get the help of a therapist. The act of discussing your feelings out loud can be interpreted an important step, rather, for self-forgiveness. Determine if the guilt is warranted. Ask yourself if everything has been done that is practical and necessary within reasonable limits. Often, the caregiver struggles to meet ever-increasing needs of their loved one at a great personal sacrifice and berate themselves for not doing more. Write down the things that make you feel guilty. Examine the underlying reasons for your guilt and determine if there are changes that can be made. Break down large problems into smaller ones. This can make them seem more manageable. Resolving a few problems can give you a sense of accomplishment and build your confidence to handle those never-ending new surprises as they arise. Concentrate on what can be done now. It's never helpful to punish yourself about the past. Resist the temptation to allow old conflicts to create guilt today. Beyond guilt, is there a payoff? Yes. You won't overcome guilt in a day. If you have a tendency towards guilt, you'll need to use these tools in order to regulate and on a regular basis to accept and learn from your mistakes. Imagine your life without guilt. I mean, imagine how you'd feel about yourself if you didn't regret your mistakes. Practice letting go. I mean, it's a matter of practicing forgiveness. If you allow yourself to recognize when you feel guilty, the caregiving process can be less draining and more fulfilling. When you are no longer burdened by the guilt, your energy returns, and you can meet the challenges with renewed vitality and strength. Managing anger. Here we are. We've reached the part where we talk about anger, and that's a big one, because in the end, we are human beings. We only have but so much time to care for our loved ones and so much time to care for ourselves. And without caring for ourselves, we're not healthy or good for the one we're caring for in this journey. So let's focus on anger now. Let's talk about it and understand that it's normal. And it's even healthy when expressed appropriately. So when we're faced with the many frustrations of caregiving, it's expected that we will get angry, and it could happen for many reasons. Sometimes our best efforts don't seem to be enough. Our loved one doesn't appreciate us or even recognize us. We might feel like we're only one who is trying to help, or we're just angry that the disease is a part of our life and is stealing our loved ones away from us. So sometimes, however, it becomes a problem. It can become a chronic condition affecting us both physically and emotionally, and affecting the lives of our loved one and everyone else around us. If we understand when anger is reasonable and when anger is unhealthy, we can better manage anger during the difficulties that come with caregiving. Some anger can be an important motivator for change, such as anger at injustice or cruelty. This kind of anger fuels efforts to make the world a better place and our own lives better. We're motivated to make that change that we wouldn't ordinarily make. We live in it and squander our lives not standing up for ourselves. So in those instances, anger can be beneficial, as in it makes us make the changes necessary to either achieve external positive change or internal emotional change. So it can give us the personal changes maybe even are afforded us when we recognize a healthy anger. So many therapists believe that anger is one of the most powerful motivating factors in successful therapy, providing the courage a person needs for change. Anger arises in response to both internal and external problems. It can result from a belief that we've been harmed or from feelings of powerlessness. When we feel threatened, we often respond in anger to keep the world at a distance and protect ourselves. Anger also works as a defense against unwanted emotions. It may be used to mask feelings of inadequacy or vulnerability, to feel stronger and cover up our fear. So anger may be used to detect hurt feelings or guilt. We might get angry to divert attention away from these other more painful feelings. As common and as the experience of anger is, most of us have not been taught how to deal with anger in a positive way. The failure to acknowledge and experience our anger can disrupt relationships, affect thinking and behavior patterns, and affect us physically, causing high blood pressure, heart problems, headaches, and digestive disorders. Some experts believe that suppressed anger is an underlying cause of both anxiety and depression. When anger becomes a problem, we get upset easily or feel irritable all the time. Anger can be contagious. The entire family can be affected by the tension anger creates. In such an environment, communication becomes strained. And we know what strained environments do. They prevent us and the people around us growth. And we find that emotional and physical abuses are more likely to occur. So instead of just feeling the anger and letting it go, we sometimes feel guilty about it and suppress it as best we can. We say things to ourselves that only make the problem worse. Like, I can't be angry at him or her when he's sick, or if I were a better daughter, or I wouldn't feel this angry. Or we think that angry means that there must be something wrong with us, and our self-esteem drops down another notch. The cycle continues without ever allowing anger to fully surface. And we know what a demon anger can be. We do, but when you repress any emotion, you're not being honest. Repression threatens connections between people and creates isolation. Being able to recognize unhealthy anger means you can channel it. It's destructive power, and integrate it into your life in a positive way. You can choose to end the spiral of guilt and low self-esteem and repressed anger causes. So embracing even your most difficult feelings can give you the peace of mind that comes from being true to yourself. Working through the anger. If we talk, it's time for some water. I'm talking a little bit much tonight because I'm running out of time and I'm trying to get as much information as I've collected for you and meet our deadline of time up on live air. Let's see, how can we make peace with this difficult emotion? The antidote to our anger problem is twofold. First, we need to give ourselves permission to experience it as immediately and completely as possible. Our inability to experience anger immediately causes it to grow powerful and take a stronger hold, turning into resentment and depression. If we allow it, anger will not poison our lives, and we will not waste valuable energy fighting it. Second, we need to address our own sense of low self-worth. The lower our self-esteem, the greater our tendency towards guilt, which increases our anger. All right, consider the following strategies for managing your anger. Practice acceptance. It's okay to feel angry. It's okay to feel angry with our loved ones when they are sick, because it's okay to be angry even when it doesn't make sense. It's okay to be unable to let go all of our anger as long as we are committed to paying attention and to not avoid it. Educate yourself. If you aren't aware of how your loved one's disease manifests itself, you may become resentful of its symptoms or try to correct behaviors which your loved one has no control. Accept that you have to join the person in his or her world because they can't join you in yours. So communicate anger effectively. Asserting your feelings clearly can help you feel better about yourself and increase your self-control in everyday situations. Recognize anger as it arises. One way to do this is to pay attention to the physical manifestation. Anger, like all emotions, is a physical experience as well as an emotional one. Our heart rate increases, we feel hotter, our throats get tighter, our heads feel like it's going to pop. Often, we don't have to do anything with our anger in order to reduce it. Sometimes it's just realizing it's there. Realizing its presence can actually let it go away, let it dissipate and vanish. Let go of your expectations. Expectations create anxiety and judgment. We worry about what's going on to happen tomorrow, or berate ourselves over what occurred yesterday. Remember, the present, right now, this moment, is the most vital, most important moment. Let go of what happened yesterday. Don't worry about tomorrow. Embrace the present. All right, this may sound a little out there, but yield to the universe. Give in to the reality that we lack power over everything. Give in to the reality that we lack power over everything. Give in to the reality that we lack power over everything. Explore different spiritualities and systems that encourage self-growth. In the end, they are about letting go. If we struggle to control the world, we're setting ourselves up to be angry. Is there a payoff? Obviously, there's a payoff. So caregiving can be the impetus for transforming yourself and your world in a positive way. We all need to take care of our emotional selves just as we need to take care of our physical selves. Rather than continue to wear anger as a mask or repress it in fear, come to terms with it. Once you face your anger, you can release it and replace it with confidence and renewed energy. It's okay to be angry. It's a healthy emotion that once recognized and let go, we can move on and be a better caregiver for our loved ones. Suppressing it is only going to make it worse, because it then becomes a debilitating, manifesting emotion that turns our lives into a wreaking havoc of medical problems in the stomach. We feel our emotions in the gut. And if we're not careful, angry gut can turn into all kinds of physical problems for us. So we want to start with getting rid of the emotions that are not good for us. And once you've done that, we'll be able to sleep better, live better, and be better caregivers. So we want to recognize the issues and deal with them as necessary so we can sleep better at night. Like following a regular schedule, go to sleep and wake up at the same time. Don't nap during the day. And I mean, this is if you're having trouble sleeping. Otherwise, new evidence suggests that nap in the early afternoon can be beneficial. Get natural light in the late afternoon each day. Be careful about what you eat. Don't drink beverages with caffeine late in the day. Don't drink alcohol or smoke. Even small amounts of alcohol make it harder to stay asleep, and it further stimulates the anger. Anger and alcohol, bad combination. Bad combination. Not only is it sleep depriving, but it is an emotional roller coaster that can be potentially fatal. I mean, depression can manifest in more ways than just physical illness. I mean, we don't want to talk about suicide tonight. That's on our agenda. But we know that anger, alcohol, and depression combined can be lethal. Remember to exercise at regular times each day. Try to finish your workout at least 3 hours before bedtime and create a comfortable place to sleep. The room should be dark, well-ventilated, and quiet. Develop a bedtime routine. Do the same things each night you tell your body that it's time to wind down, because we get into rituals that the animals in us recognize, and we, like animals, follow that routine. And if we get into the habit becomes a ritual, and the ritual becomes our routine, and that is what we want, routine, and that helps us eliminate unnecessary emotions, undesired realities that come with anger, and the incredibly clouded world of emotions that accompany caregiving, because we have to care for ourselves. We must care for ourselves as caregivers, and we wear many hats as caregivers, and we don't wear any of those hats so well with anger, depression, anxiety, denial, guilt, and poor nutrition. So with everything we've discussed tonight, all the notes we've gathered and compiled into this session, this two-hour session tonight, October 26th, 2023, we want to recognize our limits. And by recognizing our limits, we learn that we can be better suited as a caregiver for our loved ones. And with that in mind, I'm going to say thank you for listening, and I hope that you've gained something from this experience as a caregiver, because you are truly the valuable players in this reality that we call life, this journey we call existence, and this recurring dream we call life. Please, please take care of yourselves, because in order to take care of others, we're no good if we don't take care of ourselves. It's like flying. When you are on a plane, the first thing they tell you is to give yourself the oxygen first before you try to administer it to the child, because you're no good to the child if you yourself become disillusioned, disoriented, and pass out. Now you're both gone. You both are at odds. And so take care of yourself first. Otherwise, you're not going to be a valuable person to anyone else, especially the loved one who needs you most right now. In the here and now, don't let the past overwhelm the future by destroying your present. We live in the current right now, the here and now. This is truly all there is. All we have is the now. The past is a memory. The future is a dream. The reality that we have right now is our only reality. And if your reality, as you down the cycle as a caregiver, you must know that there is help out there. And even though tonight we didn't talk about brain injury specifically, we wanted to talk about caregiving and what it means. Before we go, I would like to give an opportunity for Brain Injury Association of America to give you some information that might help if you're dealing with brain trauma caregiving. So we'll be back in 37 seconds.
A brain injury can change the way you think, the way you act, the way you move, and the way you feel. If you or someone close to you has experienced a brain injury, you are not alone. More than 2.5 million children and adults sustain brain injuries in the United States each year. For help, call the Brain Injury Association of America at 1-800-444-6443, on the web at www.biausa.org. Get the help you need today.
BIAUSA.org. Contact them if your loved one is suffering from brain trauma, because severe brain trauma can wreak havoc in everyone's life. Alzheimer's, there are organizations. Find help. Seek help, because ultimately you can't do this alone, especially being the responsible person for someone who needs you so much. You must take care of yourself first so that you can sustain this incredibly, incredibly overwhelming journey. It can be overwhelming so much so that if you don't take care of yourself, you not only lose your loved one, but you lose yourself in the process, and then your loved one loses you, and then everybody's gone, and no one's here for anyone. So take care of yourself. And with that, I'd like to thank Craig Cecilia, Kim Justice, for running this network, the Brain Injury Association, the Brain Injury Radio Network. They're vital to this operation, this voice that we are given now, because Craig pays the bills around here and keeps us on the air. And Kim certainly does a good job at managing all the hosts. And you can tune in any night of the week. Every night of the week, there's a different host doing a different show and a different topic about trauma. So tune in each night of the week on Brain Injury Radio Network, and you can hear a different podcast from a different host. And if you would like, you can read my book, Surviving Head Trauma. I'm the author, Terry Smith. Surviving Head Trauma is anywhere books are available, and you can go online and order from anywhere. You can visit my website, terrysmithbooks.com, 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 and listen to any archived show of Surviving Head Trauma with Terry Smith. For 7 years or so, they're all on that site, terrysmithbooks.com. You can order from there and read short stories there. There's so many things on the website you can do if you visit terrysmithbooks.com. And also Facebook. There's a page on Facebook for Surviving Head Trauma. In fact, it's called Surviving Head Trauma. Every day there's something inspirational or educational, or sometimes just a humorous post about what we're dealing with in life, because what we're dealing with is not so common that you'll find many posts about it everywhere. But Surviving Head Trauma on Facebook is a place you can go every day and get some type of information or motivation or a little push in the back, a little handshake or a little fist bump about something to maybe make you smile or encouraged or affirm things you think are right or maybe help guide you if you're not on the right path. But visit us on Surviving Head Trauma page and Facebook. And like it and follow. We'd like to have you join us. And you can also communicate with us each night or each month when we are live. We typically talk about what interests our audience, and we get those from you writing to us, either from Facebook on Surviving Head Trauma page or through my website, terrysmithbooks.com. You can send us a topic you'd like to have on the show one night, or if you'd like to be a guest on the show, if you have a story that may be motivational or inspirational for our audience, let us know. Visit us on Surviving Head Trauma page on Facebook or terrysmithbooks.com and let us know what your issues are and if you are a good fit for the show. If you can stay up late, we're broadcasting Eastern Standard Time, midnight, 10 p.m. until midnight. And we're broadcast all over the world, wherever there's internet or wherever you listen to your podcasts. We're live once a month, but you can listen to all the archived shows at any time. Visit us LinkedIn, the Terry Smith Books page on LinkedIn. There's a link there to most of the shows and inside information about what we're doing. So there are several ways to contact us. And if you'd like to speak, of course, you can always call the show. We're on once a month, the fourth Thursday of each month, we broadcast live. And the time is 10 p.m. until midnight Eastern Standard Time. So wherever you are on the planet, you can calculate your time based on 10 p.m. until midnight Eastern Standard Time. And you can call the show from wherever you are and speak with us live. Or you can actually visit us on the website. Not the website, but the actual studio page, which is Brain Injury Radio Network. You go to blogtalkradio.com/Brain Injury Radio Network, and you can find us and actually type during the show on your computer or phone or however you communicate with us. And if you don't want to speak, you can just type to us during the show and say hello. There's usually a chat room in the studio suite, and you can communicate with us that way during a live show. But we'd like to hear from you and let us know what's going on that we might be able to help you with. And also let us know how we're doing, if we're giving you information you'd like. And keep these airwaves open for discussing the silent epidemic that we live in. It's a silent epidemic because you can't always look at someone and know that they're affected by a brain trauma. Sometimes Alzheimer's patients are undetectable by a person passing. You might not know that either. You can't always look at someone and gauge the severity of their neurological issue. Sometimes they're as rational as the people in Congress, and sometimes they're not. I mean, it's an ever-changing world and degree of severity. If you'd like to discuss how you're dealing with it or share your story with us, because sometimes hearing other stories can be enlightening and uplifting for those of us still going through those issues. Whatever the case, we hope that we've given you something tonight that you can use to help elevate your evolution, if you will, your evolving in this world of our silent epidemic. And it's also called a silent epidemic because not only can you not always look at someone and gauge where they are in the spectrum of neurological disorder, but it's a silent epidemic because people don't realize how severe these issues are until it hits them at home, until they either become a survivor of trauma or a patient of Alzheimer's or stroke or some other neurological issue. So it's a silent epidemic in multiple fronts, in that it isn't talked about so much because you don't relate to it, you don't pay attention to it until it hits home. Therefore, it's silent. It creeps upon you when someone is slowly going down the rabbit hole of Alzheimer's, or instantly in a traumatic accident or a stroke. You don't see it. You don't see it coming. So it's silent in many aspects. It doesn't have a voice. And you can't always pick someone out of a crowd who has some of these problems. Either way, we are appreciative. We are appreciative of your joining us. And we'll be back in November, and we will talk with you then. Join us next month for Surviving Head Trauma with Terry Smith. Thank you. Have a wonderful time. Whether you're listening to us archived or live tonight, we wish you love, hope, and peace. Again, thank you for joining us. Have a good night.